Been going through a series here called God and Government, and this is our fourth week in it, kind of examining, you know, that conflux of what it looks like for us to be God's people, have Jesus as our King, but also figure out what it means to be good citizens here where we live. And then we know that from time to time those things can come into conflict. You know, one of the great things this last week, I'm so glad the election and all those ads are done, but you know, one thing that's cool is, you know, you look at the returns on Wednesday morning and wonder who won, what races, and man, isn't it good to know that you don't have to wake up Wednesday morning and look and go, gee, I wonder if Jesus is still in charge of things. You know, that's always a reassuring thing to know. I told you a couple weeks ago, one of the neat things I got to do was I got to go into the public high schools, and you know, the seniors who were in civics class, they'd have a senior project in their class, and so one of the things that they had the option to talk about was the separation of church and state. So a number of years I got to go into the public high school and talk about separation of church and state and what that was all about. And it was a great history lesson for me, doing all the research and study for it and understanding, you know, how deep our roots, you know, our Christian roots run in this country, and how much that influenced the way our founders set up, you know, the system of government that they did. One of the things that when you go back and you read and you study and you look at their quotes and what they thought is you get this picture of this amazing integration that our founders didn't think that religion or Christianity in particular, it wasn't meant to be something that was a private matter. That, you know, you go to church and that's good, and God can be a part of your life when you're at home with your family or your friends that agree with you, but that's where God goes, and that's it. And you don't take God out into the rest of the world wherever you go. That place operates by a different set of rules, and we needed to go along and get along and not allow our individual faith to influence our actions out there. That's sort of how a lot of people think about their faith today, and that's how, you know, you hear politicians, and I think you hear you know, in school very oftentimes, and you know, you hear the press, you hear people talk about there ought to be this real division or separation between our faith and the state and how we live the rest of our lives out there in the public arena. And I want to take some time this morning. It's not morning anymore, is it? And I'm in trouble already. I'm digging myself a hole. I want to take some time this evening and just go back, and I want to explore what the founders actually said. And I think that you'll come to appreciate that they had this view that your religious inclinations, what you believed about God, those passions shouldn't be reserved just for home or church, but those things that you think and realize and know about God and who He is should permeate and be integrated into everything you do in life. And it may sound funny, like, why would you talk about this in church? Well, the thing I want you to think about as I go through this is I want you to think about how far we've come as a country, and John's going to talk about how we made that journey next week. But the other thing I want you to think about is what was the wisdom that the founders had to help us understand what does it look like for you know, they were trying to be God's people where they lived. What is some of the wisdom that we can learn from them about what does it look like for you and I in just a very practical way? What does it look like for you and I to be God's people living in South Lake Tahoe right here today? So I think to understand this, it's helpful to understand that before you even talk about the founding fathers, that you go back and you understand the founding of the English and the folks from Western Europe that migrated over here. Why did they come to this country? They came here because they were trying to escape political, religious persecution. They wanted to be able to worship God as they saw fit, and they didn't want the state to tell them when, how, or if they could worship God, but they wanted to have the freedom to be able to do it according to their own conscience and their own beliefs. They didn't want a prince or a king or a people to tell them when or how to do that. And, you know, it's illustrated really well. And the thing I want you to notice in this first quote, it's John Winthrop, and he was the Massachusetts Bay governor. He was elected 12 times. I want you to think about what he says here about the knowledge of the Bible. If you let people learn the Bible for themselves, how does that affect the world where those people live? Listen to what he said. Diffuse the knowledge of the Bible, and the hungry will be fed, the naked clothed. Diffuse the knowledge of the Bible, and the stranger will be sheltered, the prisoner visited, and the sick ministered unto. You can hear these right there. He's talking what? He's talking about the stories that Jesus told about how we ought to live our lives, right? We ought to be generous and feed the hungry. We ought to clothe the naked. We ought to be hospitable to other people. What's he doing? His worldview or his understanding about what the Bible says shapes, he says, if people will learn that, it will shape the decisions they make in their life. Diffuse the knowledge of the Bible and the peace of world security by more substantial safeguards than any mutual fear or reciprocal interests or prince or people can secure. Do you hear what he says there? He says, if you want to have an ordered society where people enjoy peace and prosperity, the best way to have that is to have people live under God's authority. And that's a surer way to garner peace in society than having a prince or people as a government tell you what to do. The best way to achieve that is for people in their own heart, their own conscience to say, I'll make God my ruler, my king. I'll allow God to govern my life. I think as we go through these quotes in the next couple minutes, you'll see that a couple of things stick out. Our founding fathers, you know, people say that some of them were deists, and there were a couple to be sure that were not Christians. But just to give you an illustration, 52 of the 55 signers of the Declaration of Independence were all men that belonged to Orthodox organized state churches. They were all practicing Christians in every sense of the word. They believed that the political freedoms that they set up for people to enjoy in this country, those liberties weren't something that a bunch of sharp people came up with, but they recognized that those things, they were the gift from God. And they recognized it was important to promote that reality. The third thing you find out is, I think that they also did a great job of warning us, if people aren't willing to submit themselves to God in their own life, And people just do as they see fit in their own life, there will be a government. Someone will come in and control things. Someone will come in and set up rules and regulations to order society. And there's a very good chance, and history proves this, that those people that come in and exercise authority over the common people don't generally have the best interests of the common people at heart and are not anywhere near as benevolent as Jesus is when we submit our lives to his authority. Listen to some of these quotes. Think about the integration of life and religion, particularly Christianity, that our founders said in some of these quotes. Patrick Henry, he said, it can't be emphasized too strongly or too often that this great nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians, not on religions, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. For this very reason, people of other faiths have been afforded asylum, prosperity, and freedom of worship here. It says the very thing that people came to seek to be able to have their own expression of worship, worshiping God in their own way, it's the very thing that allowed us to be welcoming to other people that may not fully have agreed or endorsed everything we believed. And that is something that, again, if you go back and you look throughout history, is really genuinely unique to the way our founders set up our country, and it's why we do have so many other folks of different points of view that live in this country. Washington said, of all the dispositions and habits, this is interesting, that lead to political prosperity. So he's saying, what makes a good government? Religion and morality are indispensable supports. He said, you want to have a good government? You've got to have religious people, both in larger society and also the folks that are setting up the system of government. Madison, our fourth president, he said, religion is the basis and foundation of government. He recognized what John talked about 2 weeks ago, that the Bible talks about why government is not a bad thing, why God uses governments for a good purpose. The belief in God, all-powerful, wise, and good, is so essential to the moral order of the world and to the happiness of men. Notice he's not just talking about government, but he says if you want to have, again, that idea of that peace and that prosperity in the world where you live, to have God as your governing authority, it's essential. Noah Webster, who was a historian and a scholar at that time, also said, "No truth is more evident to my mind than the Christian religion must be the basis of any government intended to secure the rights and privileges of a free people." He recognized you go any other direction and you allow anybody else to come in and play the part of God, they will exercise authority over people in an unhealthy way. He was a historian, and he's in the speech he's reflecting back over other history through history and other cultures and society, and he's comparing the uniqueness of Christianity and how it alone afforded people opportunities that people have not experienced throughout the history of the world. The moral principles and precepts contained in the scriptures ought to form the basis of our civil constitution and laws. I love this. What explains all the problems in the world? Listen to what he says. All the miseries and evils which men suffer from: vice, crime, ambition, injustice, slavery, and war. What's at the root of all of those things? He says they proceed from the despising or neglecting the precepts contained in the Bible. He says, you want to know where all that stuff comes from? It comes from people rebelling against God. And see, this is all reflected that the founders, these guys saw the world through very biblical eyes. All he's doing is recounting what the book of Genesis tells us, that we've gone back and talked about and talked about and talked about. That was, you know, God allowed man to have dominion or control over the earth. But it wasn't in complete autonomy. We were still supposed to have God as our governing authority. And what you see in the book of Genesis is that when Adam and Eve move out from underneath God's authority and say, hey, we've got our own ideas to how to make this work, and they started exercising their own control outside of God's authority, you see how quickly what happens. It gets messy and muddy really quickly. The book of Genesis says when people move outside underneath God's authority and they think they can do it on their own and make their own plans in life, you can see that's where moral evil raises its face. And that's all. You see that Webster, all he's doing is he's making a biblical case. He sees the world and he sees these problems and he says it's the Bible helps us understand or explain why there's moral evil in the world and what the solution to that is. Samuel Adams, the famous beer brewer, he said, "The right to freedom being the gift of the Almighty, the rights of the colonists as Christians, they may be best understood by reading and carefully studying the institutions of the greater lawgiver and head of the Christian church, which are to be found clearly written and promulgated in the New Testament." In other words, go home, read your Bibles, study them, learn them. Allow that to guide and direct your life, because that's where our freedoms come from. It's a gift from God. Benjamin Franklin, who, you know, a lot of people say that Benjamin Franklin was he's one of the guys that people say, well, that guy wasn't really a Christian. But, you know, if you go back and you read Franklin's writings, I think you could make an argument. We don't know whether, you know, how solid he was as a Christian, but there's no question, again, that even Franklin, when you read his writings, he understood how important not just religion, but particularly Christianity was in having an ordered society. And you'll hear that in this quote. Here's the other thing that most people don't recognize about Franklin when you think, well, was that guy really a Christian? George Whitefield, the great evangelist, Franklin bankrolled that guy. He was the biggest single financial supporter that guy had. That's where, you know, a ton of his money went towards. So if Franklin wasn't a Christian, he certainly understood Christianity, understood the validity and the importance of it for an ordered society, and he gave above and beyond to support the people that were going out and promoting Christianity in the countryside. So, I mean, you may say that the guy wasn't a Christian, but I think the details prove, you know, give you some pause when you say that. History will also afford the frequent opportunities of showing the necessity of a public religion. From its usefulness to the public, the advantage of a religious character among private persons, the mischievousness of superstitions, and the excellency of the Christian religion, what? Above all others, ancient or modern. Wow, is that high praise for Christianity from someone who wasn't a Christian or what? He goes on to say, the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of the truth that God governs in the affairs of men. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth, that's kind of a fun word you don't get to say every day, henceforth, that henceforth prayers imploring the audience of heaven and its blessing on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of this city be requested to officiate in that service. You know, part of what's going on here, the Continental Congress was meeting, and the very first motion that they made was, let's open in prayer. And believe it or not, there were several objections to that. Quite a few of the members there said, no, we're not going to do that. And people love to say, well, there's an example. Even our founders believed in separation of church and state. They didn't want to open in prayer. If you go back and you actually read the converse, especially Samuel Adams writes about this, the reason that some people objected to opening, you know, each session in prayer was because there were Episcopals there and Congregationalists there, Puritans there, there were Anabaptists there. And so you've got all these different Christian denominations, and you know, if you were an Episcopal, you would not have a Congregationalist pastor lead you in prayer. You know, they didn't want to be identified with Congregationalists. You know, they didn't think that was proper or right. They didn't want people to get the wrong idea about them, that people were favoring one denomination over another. So a number of the people objected to that, and Samuel Adams came to the floor and said, you know, whoever it is, as long as they're a God-fearing, upstanding person that we all respect, it's the right thing to do. And that motion carried the day. And ever since then, you know, Congress has even employed a chaplain to this day as a result, you know, of those early decisions that those guys made. John Jay was the first Supreme Court appointed by Washington. He was also an author, co-author of a number of the Federalist Papers. And I want you to listen to what the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said about Christians and about appointing Christians as our leaders. And I want you to compare it. Think of a sitting justice on the Supreme Court said this today. Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it's the duty as well as the privilege and interest of a Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. Wow. So did this guy, even though he played a very public role, did he shy away from saying, hey, you know what? God gave you this opportunity. Take advantage of it. And don't forget how important it is to have other people that hold the scriptures and the Christian religion in helping them guide the decisions that they make. Is that amazing or what? Daniel Webster, who was first a member of the House of Representatives, later a very famous lawyer, and he became a senator later in life, but he was invited to speak in 1820 at the bicentennial celebration of the Pilgrims, you know, landing in Plymouth. And he's at Plymouth 200 years later, and this is what Webster said. Let us not forget the religious character of our origins. Our fathers were brought hither by their high veneration for the Christian religion. They journeyed by its light and labored in its hope. They sought to incorporate its principles with the elements of their society and to diffuse its influence through all institutions, civil, political, and literary. It should permeate everything, he says. He goes on to say, lastly, our ancestors established their system of government on morality and religious sentiment. Moral habits, they believed, cannot safely be trusted on any other foundation than religious principles, nor any government be secure which is not supported by moral habits. I don't know if it was Dan or John quoted this last verse a couple weeks ago. Christians, whatever makes men good Christians makes them good citizens. He saw a unique and important link between those two things. If you go back and you just sort of look at the civic practices and foundations, you see that even these things carry on to today, that Congress opens in prayer, it employs an office of the chaplain to do Bible studies and give counsel to members of the House. Our military even employs, our federal tax dollars go to employing chaplains in the military. This is sort of a ceremonial thing, but again, it has its roots going back to our founders, swearing in of presidents and courts. The one thing many people don't recognize is a whole bunch of our national holidays have their roots in the that were set up by the faith of our founders. Washington's Thanksgiving Proclamation. If you guys are thinking about a good practice to adopt for your Thanksgiving, you might pull out this speech and read it to your kids and your family. It's great. Washington says, "Whereas it's the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God." You hear what he says there? He didn't just say America. He says what? All nations. He recognized that God's sovereignty wasn't just for America. It's for everybody. And he says, to obey his will. Can you imagine a president today having the guts to stand up and tell the American people that we all ought to be submitted to Almighty God and that we ought to obey his will in our life? Wow, what a different era these guys lived in. To be grateful for his benefits and humbly to implore his protection and favor. See, he recognized, man, isn't this cool? He says, we and Washington, you think about, you know, think about Washington's life for a minute. And I don't know how many of you are, you know, familiar with the Revolutionary War, but you know, if you go back and read the Revolutionary War, especially that first year of battle, it started out with an absolutely disastrous battle for the Americans. And it was followed up by another disastrous battle, followed up by another disaster. The Americans were getting wiped clean from the slate left and right in the Revolutionary War. And in fact, if you go back and you read and you look at the first year, you will marvel, how in the world did this ever come out favorably for us? Because we lost so many of the engagements. And see, Washington lived through all of that. And again and again and again, he saw that, you know what, it wasn't just luck. It wasn't happenstance that things worked out the way they did. He always saw in everything God's hand of provision, protection, and oversight that saw us through all of that stuff. And so when he was delivering this proclamation, it wasn't something that he just sort of, you know, took lightly. To him, this was life. He saw that God saw me through all of that stuff. He brought us to this amazing place today. And he's the one that not only blesses us, but he's the one who provides for us and protects us. And see, it's no different than if you go back and you read the Old Testament and you read Moses and you come to the understanding that the great leaders in the book of Judges or Joshua or Moses in their great moments, they all understood that life wasn't about luck, that God is sovereign in everything, all of the affairs of our life. And he's the one that sees us through all of this stuff. He's the one that blesses and protects us. And we ought to give him thanks and recognize what he has done for us. And that's what Washington is drawing on. Thursday, the 26th day of November, next be devoted by the people of these states to the service of that great and glorious being who is that beneficent author of all the good that was, that is, or that will be. Does this guy sound like a preacher or what? All these guys. That we may then all unite in rendering unto him our sincere and humble thanks for this kind of care and protection of the people of this country. And likewise, you think back to the National Day of Prayer that was instituted by Lincoln. You might go back and you can even see that it wasn't just Washington that did that proclamation of Thanksgiving. He wrote more than one of them. John Adams, our second president, wrote a number of them. Jefferson, our third president, he was the first guy that deviated from that, and I'll talk about that in just a minute, why he did. But Madison, our fourth president, he wrote an amazing... All of their proclamations are worth reading with your family on Thanksgiving. Pick one and read it, man. They're awesome. National Day of Prayer, Lincoln said, "Whereas the Senate of the United States devoutly recognizes the supreme authority and just government of God in all of the affairs of nations, has by a resolution requested that the president to designate and set apart a day of prayer and humiliation," and also he attached that later on in the speech, fasting. He said, "We ought to set this day apart. We all ought to fast. We ought to humble ourselves, and we ought to give thanks." You know, this part of the founder's faith, I think, is the key thing that helps us understand how completely these guys understood God's place in our life. See, I don't want you to think that I'm promoting some kind of radical patriotism or nationalism, because an undue amount of patriotism can be a dangerous thing. When you start putting your hope, your security, and your faith and trust that the government will take care of you, that's unhealthy. God never intended for us to do that. And in fact, when people start to place that kind of emphasis in the state, you can see that it can lead to disastrous consequences. My son Levi was talking to me about the World War. Why were there these world wars? He recognizes, he's starting to see that you've got this big globe and there's people are separated by a lot of water. How did we get in these fights where people went all over the place to help fight each other? And one of the things I explained to him is, you know, World War II is in large part a result of this kind of radical nationalism where people place their hope, their dreams for the future, not in God anymore, but in a political state entity. You can see that it didn't lead to a good thing. I want you to understand, I'm not promoting some kind of radical patriotism. I just want to recognize what a good thing God did when he set up this country by these men. And the freedoms that we all enjoy, that our ancestors have enjoyed, and still today, as an imperfect place as the United States is, it's still the place where people want to flock from around the world. Just simply because of the opportunities that still are afforded here that are not available anywhere else. See, but here's the thing that I want you to understand about this quote, and this is why I say these guys are so, they understood the Bible so thoroughly. He sets up this day not just as a day of celebration, but as a day of humiliation and fasting, of humbling yourself before God. There's no question that anyone who has any knowledge of the history of our country wouldn't say that our government has supported, encouraged, and endorsed some real moral evil, both here in our own country and I think in other places too, because of our messed up political interests. And I don't think anybody would deny that reality. And see, these guys all recognized just what the Bible says, that we're all people and we're all fallible. And we can all be led astray, especially when we're exercising positions of power and influence. There's very little that will corrupt us in life like having power and influence. And these guys recognize that. And almost all of them, to a man, took seriously what it meant to humble themselves and repent and ask God to forgive them and us as a country for what we did and what we've done. And see, that to me shows me how deeply these guys understood the Bible and what it says about human nature, and that even they recognized their own fallibility and how important it was for them as leaders and for us as a country to come back on a regular basis and ask God for forgiveness and ask God to help direct us in a way that would honor Him. And that's not something that is for the civic leaders, the people that represent us in Washington, D.C., but that was something that should be for all of us in our lives, ought to consider what it means for us to go back, evaluate our lives, and look at what it means to see how we've wandered and gotten out of check with the way God designed us and asked us to live, and to humble and ask for forgiveness for that. Joseph Story, who was an associate justice, he said that looking back, you know, 60 or 65 years after the Constitution was written, talking about, you know, how did that all come to be and what was the importance of it? So this guy was a sitting justice on the Supreme Court. You know, you might know this guy. He's the guy who, you seen the movie Amistad? You know, the African slaves, they got their freedom. He was the justice that wrote the opinion allowing the Africans on the slave ship to go back to Africa rather than going back to Spain as slaves. So he wrote that opinion. He said, at the time of the adoption of the Constitution and of the First Amendment to it, the general, if not universal, sentiment in America was that Christianity ought to receive what? Encouragement from the state, so far as it was not incompatible with previous rights of conscience, of freedom, of religious worship. And if you don't believe me that most of those guys were Christians and it played a serious role, look at, you know, here's a guy who wrote about that and talked about how important that was. The Continental Congress went so far, and this was 1777 when our government was having huge problems raising money to continue the war effort. One of the resolutions that they passed was that they recommended that Congress order the Committee of Commerce to import 20,000 Bibles. The government spend money on Bibles to give to our soldiers in the field so that they could have they could have God's word in their hands to help keep them. You know, it was important to have those guys be moral, upstanding people that weren't going out and raping and pillaging and taking advantage of people in the countryside. They thought that having the Bible was an important part of that. Can you imagine today if our government said, you know what, one of the best things we could spend our money on in terms of social welfare is to buy Bibles and give them to everybody and encourage people to read them. Can you imagine how well that would go over today? The Northwest Ordinance, which was as our country started to stretch westward and we were thinking about including new states, they set up some guidelines to help us figure out how to do that well. Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. And Benjamin Rush was a huge supporter of this because most of the early schools that started in this country, a majority of them were met in churches. So, one of their main textbooks was the Bible, and they were all schooled in doctrine also. And these guys said, hey, if we're going to start up these new states, these are good things to encourage them to consider. The public foundation, looking back at what, you know, their original practice, how they set things up, you can see that the first schools, they were started in churches. The Bible and basic doctrine is part of the curriculum. And this is the other big thing. You know, almost all of the, what we call, you know, the Ivy League schools, Brown, Princeton, Yale, Harvard, they were all started basically as seminaries to train preachers and lawyers. And, you know, the main, if you wanted to learn law in this country, the main textbook that you would use to study law was the Book of Romans because Paul's legal argument about atonement. And so to train lawyers, they would work them through the Book of Romans. You know, a lot of people read Romans and go, man, this stuff's hard to understand or difficult to follow. It's because it's rhetorical arguments based on one another that aren't always easy to follow. But that's why they trained lawyers with that stuff. And Princeton, like so many of the other schools, you go back and read their original charters, 1746, established by Presbyterians, and their motto was, under God's power she flourishes. And the president, Jonathan Dixon, listen to what he said about education. Cursed be all learning that's contrary to the cross of Christ. You imagine the president of Yale saying something like that today. That might not go over so well for his job security. But, you know, even like, you think about even the early states, you know, a lot of them had biblical mottos or biblical verses attached to them. Rhode Island, if you ever go to Rhode Island, you see all over the state capitol, they've got an anchor that says hope across it, and they're drawing on the picture from Hebrews. That is, our hope is anchored securely in the veil. You know, so you see that anchor and you go, well, they're by the ocean. They must like ships. No, they understood the Bible, and they were attaching the Bible to their state mottos, and that kind of stuff is all over, not just the East Coast, but, I mean, Arizona, the same thing. Look at their state seal. What happened? I promise I'm going through this as fast as I can. Hey, there we go. Woohoo! We're back. The Supreme Court even went on to say, you know, this was more than 100 years after our founders. These references add a volume of unofficial declarations to the mass of organic utterance that this is a religious people, a Christian nation. Woodrow Wilson, 28th president in 1911, even think about how he, you know, the residue was still around even then. If you don't like Wilson's politics, listen to what he said. The Bible is one of the supreme sources, supreme source of revelation of the meaning of life, the nature of God and spiritual nature and need of men. It's the only guide of life which really leads the spirit in the way of peace and salvation. America was born a Christian nation. America was born to exemplify that devotion to the elements of righteousness which are derived from the revelation of the Holy Scriptures. You know why I love this quote is because what he's drawing on here is the picture of Moses in Exodus, where in Exodus, you know, God sets out the law, and he basically what the law in Exodus is their constitution. And Moses was supposed to order the people in a way that they said, we'll make God our governor, we'll organize our lives underneath God's authority, and we will exemplify to the rest of the world what it looks like to be committed to living our lives under God's authority. That's what Exodus was all about. That was God's marching orders for those people. Wilson, isn't it interesting? What he's doing is he's connecting that same idea of basically saying that those elements of devotion to us, we were born to exemplify a commitment to God. Our country ought to be a people that are dedicated and devoted to God, and we are a light to the rest of the world for people to see and understand what it looks like to be fully committed to God in all ways. I hope that I didn't bore you with all this, but I just really want you to understand what our founders thought about the integration of religion and all areas of life, that it all ought to flow together and play a part together. Some people ask about, you know, the wall of separation, the commonly, you know, the establishment clause that we talk about so often today. I just want you to, as briefly as I can, to understand where that came from. Thomas Jefferson, who was president at the time, just after he got elected, he got a letter from a group of Baptist churches in Danbury, Connecticut, and they were thrilled to have a president who wasn't a Federalist. He was an anti-Federalist. That's a fancy way of saying Jefferson was different than both Washington and Adams, in that Washington and Adams thought that it was important to have a strong central government that exercised some influence and power over the states. Jefferson was very different in his thinking about that. He thought that the national government should have very little influence over any of the affairs of the states, and each state ought to be left up to them to decide what they want to do. Now, the Baptists in Connecticut were the minority, and they often saw or felt like the Congregationalists, who, you know, were the majority in the state, exercised the freedom of religion not as a way of saying freedom of religion is a gift from God, but they felt like the Congregationalists were sort of lording their authority and their majority over them in a way of saying, we'll allow you also to worship. And they felt like, hey, we've got just as much right as you do. That's how this whole thing got started. We may be the minority, but we should have just as much freedom and opportunity to express our faith, participate in government, as the Congregationalists do. And so they were happy that Jefferson was there. They wanted Jefferson to sort of say to the states, hey, you can't adopt or prefer any one denomination over another. Jefferson was, and he really didn't, in his letter of return, Jefferson recognized he was treading on, you know, light ground here. And Jefferson, in his reply, he went to a bunch of the politicians in New England and asked them how, you know, he wrote a letter and said, is this going to be okay? Am I framing this in a good way? Because he was nervous about giving them the wrong idea. Jefferson never directly dealt with the state issue. But Jefferson, clearly, what he said is, he said, there's a wall of separation between church and state. And all he meant, and you can go back and you can read the letter for yourself and see, what Jefferson meant and intended was just that our country will never adopt any one denomination. We'll never be an Episcopal country. We'll never be a Baptist country. We won't be a Presbyterian or Congregationalist country. Because all of the countries in Western Europe were like that, every single one of them, even today, right? Part of the money collected in taxes, if you live in England, goes to the Episcopal Church. That's their state-sponsored church. And all over Western Europe was the same. And Jefferson said, we're never going to do that. And Jefferson was so concerned about that. That's why Jefferson wasn't even willing to write one of those proclamations, those Thanksgiving proclamations. It wasn't that the guy didn't believe in God, and it wasn't that he didn't think that God played an important role in civic life, but he didn't want to tell people, the government tells you you need to worship God. He firmly believed that everybody, according to your own conscience, the only way to have really good citizens is for you and you and you and you to choose it. It can't come from coercion of the state telling you, you have to do this. He wasn't against pointing out and celebrating the good things about Christianity, but he wanted to be careful not to coerce anybody. But listen to what Jefferson in his own writings said about the importance of God in everyday life. And remember, he's the guy who wrote the preamble to our Constitution, that we have unalienable rights given to us by God, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. He's the guy who wrote that stuff. He recognized its importance and the part it plays in our life. God, who gave us life, he gave us liberty. And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we've removed the only firm basis a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God. The guy thoroughly understood the importance and benefit of Christianity, but he said, you got to choose it. It can't be pushed on you by coercion. That's dangerous. I also told you at the beginning, these guys all recognized that if you got away from those Christian principles, the society at large chose not to live under God's authority, that there'd be consequences. John Adams, of course, he said, you know, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. In other words, he said, the minute we get out from underneath God's authority as a people, and we think we can do this on our own or make up our own ideas about what morality is like, he said, the Constitution's useless. It won't do you any good. He says it's wholly inadequate for the government of any other people because it was set up to be limited, that people would choose to allow God to be their authority. And the minute you stop doing that, what he was saying is somebody else will come in and exercise authority over you. And of course, Washington, you know, one of his most famous quotes was in his farewell address. He said, "And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. Don't think that you can figure out a better way to do this yourself. Reason what we think, if we think this through, and our experience. If we look around, we can see that it doesn't work. They both forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in the exclusion of religious principles." Okay, you're sick of this stuff, but I just want you to understand how thoroughly these guys saw the integration between religion and everyday life, particularly political life. And some of you go, "Well, that's great, Noah, but we came to hear about the Bible." This is the Bible. These people were influenced and understood the world through biblical eyes. So they stand as examples for us as to what it looks like for us to live out our Christian values in everyday life. I've no idea what's going on here. What did I do? Where's my... Man, oh man, I got out of order. I think John came up here and played with my slides. He's busted. Okay, four things you can take away in your notes here that I think these guys help us think through how to apply what the Bible tells us in our own lives. The book of Psalms, if you read through the book of Psalms, 209 times the book of Psalms calls us to give thanks to God, to recognize His goodness in our life. I don't know if you're like me, but one of the things I love reading these quotes, you see how these guys, they all understood life wasn't a set of happenstance or luck. They all understood God's, you know, sovereignty. And the good things that they had in their life, they recognized that all things come from God. He's the source of the blessings that we enjoy, and they were quick to thank Him. I think in my own life, you know, if you ask me what's going on, I could tell you really quickly why I'm frustrated, you know, how I'd like things to be better, what happened that made me frustrated this week, what I'm angry about, you know, what disappointments I have, what I'd really like to have, you know, be better in my life. I could grumble and give you a list really quick of where I'm frustrated or upset in my life. And if you ask me, well, aren't there some good things going on in your life? I go, well, yeah, I guess so. You know, but it would take me a little bit longer to go through and count my blessings, to go through and think of the good things that God has done for me in my life. And yet the reality is, if I really stopped and I really made an honest list or accounting of my life, that list on the good side would so outweigh the other. And yet I have this nasty tendency to focus on the negative. And see, we sort of live in a negative culture. And I think it's not hard to see going through this last election cycle. Think of how many of those ads were negative ads. And the reason they're negative is because, polling tells them that negative advertising works. Because we're cynical about life and about people, and especially about politics. So it's easy for us to start thinking evil about our, you know, whoever's running for political office. And one of the things I think is so important is that we learn, like these guys, I thought they do a magnificent job of recognizing what a good God we have, and how much He's done for us, and make thanking Him a regular part of our lives, especially with our families. See, I recognize that tendency that I have in my own life to focus on the negative. So one of the things that I've done is every night when we go to bed, and you can ask my boys, the very first thing we do is we just go around in a circle, and I just ask them, I said, what are you thankful for? And we include that in our prayers every night. And I don't let them get away with it. They'll, you know, if they're lazy, they just go, I'm thankful for a good day. You know, and I make them be specific. Because every day God is doing good things that we can be thankful and appreciative for. And so that's, you know, I'm trying to help them cultivate in their own hearts and minds, you know, an appreciation for the good things that God does for us in our lives. The second thing, and this may sound funny to you, but the second thing I think the founders exemplify for us is this attitude that we're all in this together. We're a community of people. And what we tend to do, if you're like me at all, is you look at the world, you look at South Lake Tahoe, you read the local paper, and you go, I can't believe these people think like that. I can't believe they want to do this. And you go, this is the reason we've got all these problems, is because of people like that. And in my head, what I'm thinking subconsciously is, I've got it all together. And if everybody else would just sort of come along and be more moral like I am, we wouldn't have these issues. I look at you look at the state of California or Nevada, wherever you live, and you go, the problems that we have in the state are a result of blah, 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 whoever you want to blame. And what we do when we do that, you know what we're doing? We're setting us up over here. We have the moral high ground, and the problems that we experience are their fault. And we're kind of dividing ourselves, not recognizing that we're a community in this together, and we sink or swim together. And when things don't go well, we all share in the blame, believe it or not. And I'll show you a passage in just a minute that I think helps us understand this. My boys, the other day we were driving down to Gardnerville to see grandparents, and I told the kids, and some people will say, well, that's coercion. You can't do that. But I don't think it's coercion. I think it's helping my kids understand that you get rewarded when you do things well, and I think it's also helping them understand teamwork. There are some things that needed to get done before we left the house. And I told them, hey, you know what, we'll stop and get hot chocolate on the way down the hill. And Avila, our 2-year-old girl, goes, hot chocolate? Hot chocolate? Yeah, she's all excited. But my boys, I told them, you know, they've all got responsibilities in the house. And I told them, here, you know, Levi, here's your job. Davin, here's your job. Travis, here's your job. And I said, if all of the jobs aren't done, we won't get hot chocolate. Why would I do that? Because I want them to understand that leaving the house, we're a family. We leave the house together as a family when all the things are done. So Levi, if you get done first, I don't say this to them anymore. He understands now. In order for us to get out of here, in order for us to get hot chocolate, this is a team project. We're in this together. We're rewarded or suffer together as a family. Even if I do my job well, if everybody else isn't doing their job well, it's not going to work out well for all of us. So there's a sense in which we're all in this together. And I think that's how God looks at life and orders societies. Now, I want to read you this quick passage in Nehemiah where, you know, this guy's living, he's living in captivity in Babylon. And certainly it wasn't his fault. He's a good guy. And, you know, it's like he could have played that blame game and he could have been right. We're here and it's not my fault, he could have said. But I want to read to you what he says in chapter 1 when he prays in verse 6. He says, let your ears be attentive and your eyes be open to hear. The prayer of your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. We've acted very wickedly towards you. We've not obeyed your commandments and decrees. I love this. I mean, Nehemiah, here's a guy who was without blame. He could have said, we're here and it's not my fault. It's the fault of the people that lived before me. But he recognized somehow that, you know what? I may not be as guilty as they are. I may not have done all that they did, but he still recognized his own fallibility as a person and as a leader. And that he incurred some guilt in his own life. And that it's not just other people's fault, but it's all of our fault. And that's why this idea that these guys set up of his national days of mourning and fasting and asking for forgiveness and recognizing that we're all fallible and we all blow it in our lives and none of us is perfect, and that we're all in this together, is something that I absolutely love. And it helps me see, when I think of the world in that way, it stops me from doing, I'm right, I'm over here, you're wrong, you're over there. And when I start living like that, what I do is, I divide a wall. The good people are over here on this side, the bad people are over there. And I start building these boxes. Who's in, who's out? And see, God expects me to be involved in everybody's life, not just the people in a certain box. My neighbors may not believe the same thing as I do, but that doesn't mean I don't have a personal responsibility to them and their life to be involved in what's going on in my community at large. See, and this goes back to the book of Genesis, where Abel talking about the murder of his brother Cain, and God says to him, you know, where's your brother? And he says, am I my brother's keeper? You know, he's basically using that thing. I'm responsible for myself and I'm responsible to you. I don't know what's going on with that guy. And God doesn't let him off the hook with that. God says, you are your brother's keeper. You do have some moral responsibility here. And when we start doing that, us against them, we start separating ourselves. And that gives us the excuse to not be involved. It gives us the excuse to feel like we're not really all in this together, which I think is not a healthy way to live. So I think it's important for us to recognize that as a country where we have failed God, we ask for forgiveness, recognizing that we are a part of the moral evil that's been perpetrated. The other thing these guys illustrate so well for us is that the Bible, it's our basic road map for navigating all of life. See, think about how these guys viewed the big questions of life that everybody asks. People all want to know, well, how did we get here? Was it evolution? Was there a God who was involved? Is there some other answer for how we all got here? Did aliens come and plant us here? Everybody's got an answer to that question. These guys all understood what? We are made in God's image. We're all unique. We're important. That's what gives us all individual worth in God's sight. That's an important part of how they saw the world. It had an important part in how they treated each other. If we answer that question that same way, it helps us understand how to treat other people. They looked around and they saw that the world was messed up, that there was real moral evil in the world. And how did they answer? Well, how did we get in the mess that we're in? They understood that the moral evil that's perpetrated in the world is from man rebelling against God's authority. They understood that leads to problems. And they also understood, well, what's the solution to help pull things back together the way God designed? It was for what? For us to get ourselves back under God's authority. These guys answered the big questions of life right out of the pages of the Bible, and it influenced how they saw not only their own lives, but it even permeated how they saw government and what government's responsibility was in the world. And fourthly, what did they see? This idea that there ought to be a wall, that religion or Christianity, it ought to be just a private thing, that you're... Whatever you think about God and talk about God, it's okay to do in church. It's okay to do in your home, but don't take it out in the rest of the world where you live. They did not see a wall there. I hope you can understand that from reading that. And that's the way God expects us to live. That our understanding of God, how He shapes our life, is not something personal alone. It's not something just for our family or our friends at church on Sunday, but it ought to permeate how we live all of our life. But I'm afraid to say that I think so many of us live in that world where we do see a divide between our religious life and what we do out in the public sphere. I'm out at Starbucks about a year ago, and I'm with this great Christian family, and they come up here from time to time, and we were talking, and one of them is a school teacher, and they were saying about they'd love to leave where they're living and their jobs and do ministry, full-time ministry, go out on the field and be missionaries, and what a neat thing that would be. And in the course of the conversation, they were asking me some questions about my life, and I told them, you know, at one point I kind of thought, you know what, I'm not sure that I want to work in the church. That's what I want to do for my vocation. That's how, you know, I want to earn my living. And the person said to me, well, wouldn't you miss full-time ministry. And see, the way that they were talking about the world was the way I think a lot of us think about life. That ministry is about, there's sort of this category of life that has to do with God stuff. And then there's this category of life that just has to do with sort of life stuff. Work and, you know, taking care of your house and other, you know, whatever. There's other stuff that's just life stuff. And, you know, that God stuff is ministry. So, like, especially if you're a pastor or a missionary, that's full-time ministry. You're getting paid to do God stuff full-time. You know, or people will say, you know, I wish I had more free time to do more, help me out here, ministry. You know, and what they're thinking is I'd like to get more involved with some of the things that the church is doing. They hear about the ESL program that we got going here, and they go, man, I'd love to be a part of that ministry. Soup kitchen on Wednesday night, they go, I'd love to be a part of that ministry. Worship up here, I'd love to be a part of that ministry. You know, there's this church stuff that's ministry related. People say, I can't wait to retire because I want to spend more time doing ministry. I hear this talk all the time, and what it does is people are thinking that there's God stuff that we do, and then there's the rest of my life. And you know what I told them as we were talking about my life, even if I wasn't paid to work in the church, I still do ministry full time. I'm a father. I have a responsibility to minister to my children. I'm a husband. God expects me to be a full time ministry, you know, to my wife. That's ministry. I have neighbors and friends. And as Monterey, I had these athletic things that I was doing, and all of them were opportunities for. You're sort of getting it. See, if you're a mom or a dad, you're an employee, and you're a supervisor, and you have people working under you, it's an opportunity for ministry. There's about half of you that are getting this, I can tell. Half of you are just still asleep and trying to figure out why we're here so long tonight. See, this is the thing. God needs bartenders. He needs people who are dealers in the casinos. Well, I was talking with a real estate agent after first service and talking about how their work is a ministry. See, you can choose to do your work to benefit and build up your own life. And they found that in the realty profession, there are a lot of people that aren't necessarily always honest and don't always have integrity at the height of what they're doing. And see, that's they're the people that they work with, their clients. It's an opportunity to be honest, work with integrity. And what you're doing when you're doing those things, you're shaping the world in a way that says, God and His principles, I live under His authority, and it shapes everything I do. Everywhere I go, every relationship I have is shaped because it's all. Okay. I'm going to give we can be done here as soon as everybody gets this. I just want to make sure you're all on the same page with me. All of life is an opportunity for
ministry.
Okay, I'll let you go with that. God, thanks for the opportunity to get together tonight. Lord, help us to take advantage of every opportunity to do ministry. And thanks, Lord, that you've given us biblical examples, whether it's Daniel or Joseph, Paul under a Roman authority, or the founders. There's so much we can learn about what it looks like to have our dedication and desire to live for you permeate every aspect of our life. And thank you for the opportunity to think about what that looks like tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.